Welcome to the Cancer Care Workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. If you should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Chenitha, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Current Trends in Oral and Head and Neck Cancer. It's a very important program that we're offering today, and it's a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have on the call today over 532 participants, and you come from all over the United States, and you also have international participants from Canada, China, India, Korea, Portugal, Syria, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world, really a group of information seekers. Today's program is made possible by a charitable contribution from Bristol-Myers Squibb and ImClone Systems, a wholly owned subsidiary of Eli Lilly and Company, and I really want to thank them for their support of the program. I would like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there are information about all of the different collaborating organizations and resource information about them. And there also is an evaluation form. And I'm going to ask all of you at the end of the program today to please complete the evaluation forms. We very much depend upon your feedback to some extent because you can tell us what you want us to offer. You have a very good sense of what you need. And we try very hard to offer the programs that you suggest. Indeed, this particular program was one that you had asked for, and here it is. So we really do very much rely on your recommendations. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to start by introducing our very first speaker, Dr. Terry Day. Dr. Day is Professor and Director, Head and Neck Tumor Center, Hollings Cancer Center, Medical University of South Carolina. And Dr. Day is going to address progress in the treatment of oral and head and neck cancer, and coping with surgery and reconstruction. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Day.
Thank you, Carolyn. First, I would like to thank Cancer Care and all of the sponsors and contributors for their commitment to the patients, families, and friends affected by head and neck cancer. The modified format today with the topics that are listed really emphasize the importance of family, social interaction, and psychosocial factors that affect patients and others involved in the treatment of head and neck cancer. As in the past teleconferences and national meetings on head and neck cancer, I'd like to begin by emphasizing the need for a multidisciplinary approach to both the diagnosis and treatment that includes specialists in psychology, psychiatry, palliative care, social work, chemotherapy, radiation therapy, otolaryngology and head and neck surgery, dental oncology, prosthodontic, speech pathology, nursing, nutrition, even reconstructive surgery, radiology and pathology, and many, many others. It's a complicated disease, and the treatment and rehabilitation is also complicated. Today, I'll cover a brief overview of head and neck cancer along with the recent progress in the treatment of oral and head and neck cancer and coping with surgery and reconstruction. So really, our first section is just a brief overview to update everybody and make sure we understand what head and neck cancer is. First, we have to begin with the definition. Oral head and neck cancer is a cancer that affects the upper aerodigestive tract of the head and neck. This includes the parts of the throat and lined surfaces of the nose, mouth, sinuses, and voice box. There are over 40,000 head and neck squamous cell carcinomas per year in the United States, with almost all treatable and potentially curable. It's frequent that doctors involved in treating cancers of these sites also treat other sites and types of cancers that begin in the head and neck, and that includes salivary gland cancers, sinus, nasopharynx, skin cancers, melanoma, thyroid cancers, and sarcomas. Due to the limited time today, we will not cover these areas in great detail, but it's important to know that the side effects of surgery, chemotherapy, radiation therapy, and the treatment of these tumors may also be similar and require similar multidisciplinary teams. Next, I'd like to go to the diagnosis, and this will be brief, but it's important. The diagnosis of early head and neck cancer is typically made when a physician or dentist identifies a red or white patch in the mouth or throat. Thus, any sore in the mouth, throat, change in voice, or other problems that don't resolve on their own should be evaluated by a specialist. Sometimes, however, head and neck cancers first show up as in a large lymph node in the neck area. So thus, any adult with a lump in the neck should also have it evaluated. Of course, most head and neck cancers have been found to be related to smoking. However, it's now well known that half and maybe more of cancers of the back of the tongue or tonsil are related to a virus, the human papillomavirus, or HPV. Thus, even if you don't smoke cigarettes, it's important to get checked if you have any of these signs or symptoms. If you do have an oropharyngeal cancer, ask your physician if it should be treated or the testing should be done for the virus. Coincidentally, several weeks ago was the International Oral Head and Neck Cancer Awareness Free Screening Day. Over 200 locations in the U.S. and over 30 countries around the world participated in this program. To find out more, you can go to ohancaw.com to find a site near you. Once a spot or a tumor is identified in the mouth or the throat, the patient may be referred to a specialist for a biopsy. Before or after the biopsy is done, patients may be scheduled for a CAT scan, an MRI, or a CT PET scan to look for the tumor or to see if it has spread. In most cases, a biopsy of the tumor site or a lump in the neck, otherwise known as a lymph node, can provide the cell type of the tumor. The results of the biopsy and the site of the tumor often directs treatment recommendations. It is at this time that the patient should be referred to a multidisciplinary team of specialists that often, at a minimum, includes a surgeon, radiation oncologist, and medical oncologist specializing in head and neck cancer. The next brief topic will be the stage, and it's important to understand the stage. The stage not only affects the cure rate, but the treatment and the rehabilitation and side effects. So after the scans and the biopsy, the patient is given a stage of the tumor, and the stage is based on the letters T, N, and M. T stands for the tumor, or the site that the cancer began. N stands for the lymph nodes, or possible spread of the tumor to the lymph nodes of the neck. And M stands for metastasis, or spread through the bloodstream to other parts of the body. The entire T and M stage is then grouped into an overall stage, and this is from the American Joint Committee on Cancer, AJCC, and details on treatment by this AJCC stage can be found at nccn.org. Next, I'll go into the progress in the treatment of oral and head and neck cancer. The recent advances are many, and we're fortunate to have Dr. Posner on briefly to talk about the advances in treatment related to chemotherapy and radiation therapy, which are very important. It is well understood from scientific research, clinical trials, and published experiences that each stage, site, and type of cancer should be treated in a certain way. However, as more information becomes available, the controversies and options for each stage and site may become confusing to the patient and family during such a strenuous time. Let me summarize the treatment of head and neck cancer in just a few sentences, and then I'll expand on this. In general, all head and neck cancers are treated with either surgery or radiation therapy, and one or both of these comprise the curative treatment modality. Chemotherapy may also be added, and targeted therapy may also be added in certain circumstances. Most head and neck cancers, however, will be treated with combinations of treatment that will include a variety of combinations and sequences of surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy. In brief, early stage or stage 1 or 2 cancers can be cured with either surgery or radiation alone without combination treatment or chemotherapy. Advanced stage or stage 3 and 4 cancers are often treated with one of three combinations: surgery followed by radiation, chemotherapy and radiation, or surgery and radiation and chemotherapy. Targeted molecular therapy, including cetuximab, may also be indicated or added for certain stages or other indications. Dr. Posner will go in much greater detail on the chemotherapy and radiation therapy options for treatment. so I will discuss briefly advances in surgical therapy and reconstruction. Surgery for early stages can be performed in many cases now in 2011 with what is considered minimally invasive techniques, including surgery without incisions on the face or the neck. These procedures are performed transorally through the mouth or transnasally through the nose with magnified endoscopes, telescopes, 3D images, robotic, and laser techniques. Many of these procedures can now be performed with same-day surgery or shorter stays in the hospital without a tracheotomy or without feeding tubes. This does present a good option for individuals in addition to receiving radiation for early-stage cancers. Advances in stage 3 and 4 head and neck cancer surgery includes the option of removal of the cancer, lymph nodes with minimally invasive techniques, but also rebuilding or reconstructing the area with free flaps or microvascular free tissue transfer to allow for function of the tongue, throat, and voice box, which was not possible before. These are essentially transplants of tissue from the same patient to rebuild the removed areas. Now I'd like to discuss a very important topic to end, and that is coping with surgery and reconstruction. This is one of the most important aspects of head and neck cancer treatment, and it's the psychosocial issues surrounding cancer treatment. Fortunately, there are experts that will be discussing this in much greater detail, but as a surgeon, I've experienced it firsthand with my patients and their families. In my early years of caring for patients and their families with head and neck cancer, I thought their primary focus was curing the cancer. As years went on, I realized that many people prioritize their quality of life or function or cosmetic result as much as the cure of the cancer. Thus, I now spend as much time, I've added time, on quality of life, psychosocial aspects, and function as I do when discussing the treatment of the cancer. It's quite difficult for a patient or family member to think about the treatment and cure, let alone long-term cosmetic, functional, and psychosocial issues. I do recommend that patients consider and pursue visits with their primary physician, psychologist, social workers, and psychiatrist to optimize the long-term outcomes once cancer treatment is completed. Despite extensive informed consent, it's sometimes difficult for the patient to comprehend all the aspects surrounding chewing, speaking, and the cosmetic results. Many of the large head and neck cancer centers in the United States will offer psychosocial, palliative care, and psychiatric care as part of the treatment and rehabilitation. It's important for people to understand that the effects can be ongoing before, during, and after their treatment and know how to handle these issues. It has been a privilege participating in this important teleconference, and I encourage everyone to continue their efforts to improve research funding, education, and awareness that results in eventual eradication of this disease. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Day, for an excellent presentation and very informative overview of oral and head and neck cancer. I think everyone has learned a great deal from what you said, and I thank you for your very comprehensive and caring remarks as well. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Marshall Posner. Dr. Posner is he's director, head and neck medical oncology, professor of medicine at Tisch Cancer Institute, Mount Sinai School of Medicine. And Dr. Posner is going to address chemotherapy and radiation treatment updates for oral and head and neck cancer. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Posner.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation to talk with Cancer Care. I'm going to be talking about the current updates in chemotherapy and radiation treatment for oral and head and neck cancer. I'd like to start by saying that there were some interesting new data that were presented at the ASCO meeting. We saw some updates on some clinical trials that suggest that induction chemotherapy works extraordinarily well in patients with very advanced oral and head and neck cancers. The 10-year data from the TAX-323 trial, which was presented by Dr. Vermorken's group, showed the consistent improvement in survival with the more intensive chemotherapy regimen, which were very sustained and meaningful and associated with less toxicity. So induction chemotherapy continues to be useful for patients with fairly advanced cancers who have not had prior treatment and in whom a curative option seems to be indicated. And I think that was very important data as well for patients with early cancers where organ preservation and function are an important consideration. There were other studies that took a look at the impact of HPV on the incidence of cancer, and there was a particular presentation by Dr. Anil Chaturvedi from the CDC. The CDC and a group of researchers determined that there was a 2- to 4-fold increase in the rate of HPV-related oropharynx cancers. Those are cancers of the tongue and tonsil, and that this increase really replaced the reduction in cancer incidence seen with the reduction in smoking that has occurred throughout the nation. So as the number of people who smoke reduced, the number of patients with this particular cancer seemed to increase, and this increase is very important because patients with this particular kind of cancer actually do phenomenally better than patients who have smoking-related cancer. And so the treatment options become much more varied and possibly even reduced for these patients in the future. And there were a number of studies around the possibility of reducing treatment for these patients. Currently, there's actually a study being performed by the Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group for patients with HPV-related oropharynx cancer in which the dose of radiation therapy has been reduced to about 75% of the standard dose in an attempt to reduce the toxicity. These patients receive a course of induction chemotherapy and then a lower dose of radiation with the drug Erbitux. The Radiation Therapy Oncology Group took a different tack, and they are actually performing a study for patients with HPV-related oropharynx cancer that involves an elimination of chemotherapy and only radiation or Erbitux, an anti-EGFR receptor, and that study is also going to be open. And so there are a number of options for actually reduced therapy for patients with these tumors. This is very gratifying, and I think we're going to see vaccines in this population in the next 4 or 5 years as well to try and attack in an immune therapeutic way these tumors and get the body to eliminate these virally related cancers. There were a number of studies that suggested that we can use imaging and scanning to assess patients better as to the extent of disease. And I think today, almost everybody who has an oral cavity cancer or a head and neck tumor of the oropharynx or larynx will be undergoing PET scanning, as well as assessment of the tumor post-therapeutically by PET scanning as well. So an initial evaluation by PET scanning appears to be necessary to fully define the extent to help the radiation oncologist, the surgeon, and the medical oncologist to really understand the extent of disease and how intensive or how little the therapy needs to be applied for each of the individuals. We are now using a PET and CT scanning after therapy is over to assess whether the patient needs additional treatment. For example, if a patient received chemotherapy and radiation and they had a positive PET scan, they might be a candidate for a neck dissection or an operation for persistent disease. But if the PET scan were negative at 12 to 16 weeks after the completion of chemotherapy and radiation, the likelihood of there being a positive finding is very, very low, and these patients would be spared needless surgeries that we were performing in the past. So I think this is a very important finding and has been bolstered by a number of studies. What's important in understanding this is that there is a critical time element. So patients who are going to have PET scanning after radiation or surgery should have it done certainly 12 to 16 weeks after the treatment is completed rather than earlier because of the number of false positives. And I think generally, the outlook for patients with head and neck cancer has improved dramatically. One of the major improvements being the identification of HPV, not simply because patients with HPV do better, but because now we understand that patients who do not have HPV need more therapy and more intensive treatment in order to eradicate their cancers. And so we can now identify molecular markers in these individuals, as well as new treatments that might be beneficial for patients with the non-HPV-related tumors. So I think all in all, the outlook for patients with oral and head and neck cancer is improving dramatically, and hopefully there will be less in the way of toxicity and side effects for patients when they complete treatment now that we have good IMRT and improved ability to identify persistent or recurrent disease in the patient population.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Posner, for just a wonderfully informative presentation, lots of excellent information, and a lot of information for people to take back to the treating healthcare team. Thank you so much. Our next speaker is Dr. Jan Lewin. And Dr. Lewin is a professor, Department of Head and Neck Surgery. She's director, Section of Speech, Pathology, and Audiology, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Lewin is going to address speech and swallowing challenges and issues around how those impact sometimes your social interactions. Dr. Lewin?
Thank you, Carolyn. It's always a pleasure to participate in the cancer care conferences because they are always so informative and well-organized. The impact of oral and head and neck cancer and its treatment on speech and swallowing function can be significant. Patients with these types of cancers experience functional disabilities associated with the tumor itself, as well as treatment-related morbidity. Because the functional impairments often lead to impaired social interactions and worsened quality of life, it is important to weigh the sequelae associated with choosing a particular cancer therapy against the desire to preserve function, physical appearance, and quality of life. This is a very important point. For some early types of cancer, in particular larynx cancer, the patient's overall survival may be the same whether he or she is treated with radiation or surgery. However, the functional outcome, that is, speech and or swallowing, may be very different depending on the type of treatment selected. Therefore, pre-treatment speech and swallowing evaluation for all patients with head and neck cancer is important not only for counseling, but also to establish a baseline of functioning for post-treatment comparison and planning. Swallowing ability cannot be reliably inferred from subjective reports. In some cases, patients report no problem swallowing, while in fact they are silently, without coughing or any other indication, aspirating what they swallow. Objective assessments are indicated for all head and neck cancer patients with or at risk for swallowing problems or aspiration. They are the only way to ensure reliable evaluation of swallowing function. Two ways to assess swallowing are the modified barium swallow examination, a radiologic procedure, and the gold standard for assessing swallowing, and the flexible endoscopic evaluation of swallowing, often known as FEES. This test uses a flexible endoscope to examine swallowing and can be done as an office procedure or at the patient's bedside. Video stroboscopy can be done in the office and is the best clinical assessment to visualize the larynx and objectively evaluate the voice. In most cases, there are options to fix and improve vocal fold problems and poor voice. One other complication that is very common after head and neck cancer and its treatment is lymphedema. Although most people are familiar with the swelling that occurs in the limbs, particularly in the arms of patients treated for breast cancer, this swelling, or what is referred to as lymphedema, is a common and frequently severe complication of cancer treatments for patients with head and neck malignancies. When lymphedema affects the head and neck region, the cosmetic and functional consequences can often result in problems with articulation, difficulty swallowing, drooling, impaired vision, respiratory obstruction, and poor self-image. Although swelling of the tissue is common right after surgery or radiation therapy, swelling that does not resolve over time should be evaluated, as this may be lymphedema that will likely require formal therapy to help eliminate. Generally, lymphedema therapy is provided by certified physical therapists. However, at MD Anderson Cancer Center, treatment of lymphedema in the head and neck region is usually provided by certified members of the speech pathology team, and the results, I can tell you, are often amazing and take place after a single session. Now, after surgery, the functional disability is usually proportional to the volume of resection. Data has shown that appropriate swallowing rehabilitation can eliminate aspiration, reduce the risk for pneumonia, and successfully return over 80% of select patients who aspirate to oral intake, even years after the completion of their treatment. Remember that feeding tubes and tracheotomies will not prevent aspiration, but they may reduce it, and they also may improve pulmonary functioning. Emerging data support the use of preventative swallowing exercises by patients with head and neck cancer that start early before the cancer treatment begins. There are no pills, no medications, and in most cases, no surgeries that will fix swallowing problems. Therefore, it is important for patients to ask for a speech pathology appointment if one has not been scheduled. New data shows that laser surgeries, especially laser resections of small tumors, may have better functional outcomes than traditional surgeries and also radiation therapy. After laser surgery, patients generally have shorter hospital stays and experience faster medical recovery. In select cases, radiation therapy may even be avoided. Patients frequently regain swallowing ability faster without the severe side effects caused by radiation therapy. However, laser surgery cannot be done for all patients and in some cases may be contraindicated. Highly experienced surgeons and speech pathologists should be able to provide evidence-based information to help you select the right alternative to treat your cancer while at the same time preserve the ability to speak and swallow. Now, when you speak about the effects of radiation therapy, we have to remember that these effects may include immediate as well as long-term changes in speech, voice, and swallowing that may increase in severity years after the completion of the radiation treatment. In general, however, radiation has a greater effect on swallowing than it does on speech. Patients who have swallowing problems before treatment are at higher risk for chronic swallowing disability after treatment and also are at higher risk for permanent feeding tube dependence. The addition of chemotherapy in some cases can make the problems worse because chemotherapy accentuates the effects of the radiation. However, recent results indicate that when chemotherapy is used alone prior to radiation therapy to treat tumors of the oral cavity or larynx, it does not impair swallowing. In fact, patients may even report improved ability to eat and reduction in pain following their chemotherapy. Early swallowing recovery from radiation therapy may be misleading because of the delayed scarring and fibrosis and the occurrence of neuropathies that cause long-term swallowing deterioration. Late swallowing dysfunction and aspiration have been reported in up to 60% of patients, and between 15 and 30% of patients who aspirate will require a gastrostomy tube for nutrition. Experience shows that delaying the placement of a feeding tube instead of putting one in immediately before radiation begins may, in fact, help preserve long-term swallowing function. But whether or not a feeding tube is placed, it is essential to continue to swallow whatever you can, even if it is just your own saliva, throughout the course of radiation therapy to maintain the ability to swallow long-term. The literature also tells us that in many instances, patients are not aware that they are aspirating what they eat and drink until the aspiration causes pneumonia, because what is happening is that they are aspirating silently without coughing or clearing their throat. Again, evaluation by an experienced speech pathologist can identify silent aspiration. Recent data from MD Anderson Cancer Center has shown that adherence to swallowing exercises can improve and maintain swallowing function after radiation. Patients should ask for these exercises before radiation therapy begins and should continue to do them throughout their treatment as much as possible. Many of you are already aware, IMRT is designed to target the tumor but spare critical organs for speech and swallowing and has helped to preserve function after treatment. Data from MD Anderson shows when the larynx is not involved with cancer, the use of a traditional larynx block in combination with IMRT can spare critical parts of the larynx from excessive radiation and ultimately decrease the risk of chronic swallowing problems. Therefore, a good question to ask your radiation oncologist is, will I be receiving IMRT and do you use a traditional larynx block with the IMRT? In addition, the use of targeted molecular therapies or biologic treatments in combination with radiation-based treatment is increasing. These types of treatments are designed to target specific genetic alterations in the tumor itself and spare normal tissue cells from damage. Again, early data suggests that acute mucosal toxicity and swallowing outcomes are not worsened by the addition of targeted molecular drugs to radiation. In conclusion, the best prevention of long-term speech and swallowing dysfunction is to avoid unnecessary radiation or surgery to key anatomical structures, delay feeding tube placement as tolerated, start swallowing therapy early, and keep on swallowing to maintain physiology and avoid fibrosis. We must optimize pain and discomfort, and it is most important that the members of the multidisciplinary team work together to treat the patient and the cancer. Ultimately, it is critical that you seek information and treatment from experts who are very familiar with head and neck cancer, its diagnosis, treatment, and its functional sequelae. Finally, we at MD Anderson Cancer Center, along with colleagues from around the country and the world, are working to develop a predictive model for the prevention of speech and swallowing dysfunction so that we can identify those patients who are at risk before they begin their therapy, to ultimately avoid long-term functional deterioration after treatment for head and neck cancer. Again, thank you, Carolyn, for inviting me to speak as part of this multidisciplinary presentation. It's really been my pleasure.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Lewin. Excellent presentation, as always, and also for highlighting the importance of everyone working with that multidisciplinary team. That's a theme that you're hearing from Dr. Day and Dr. Posner and now Dr. Lewin. And so it's just so very important, and thank you so much for that outstanding presentation. Our next speaker is Dr. Stuart Fleischman. Dr. Fleischman is Founding Director, Cancer Supportive Services, Continuum Cancer Centers of New York, Beth Israel, and St. Luke's Roosevelt. And Dr. Fleischman is going to address assessment of biopsychosocial and spiritual components of pain, dealing with sadness, depression, and social anxiety, the multidisciplinary care toolbox, and he's also going to talk about some practical tips to cope with social interaction. Dr. Fleischman?
Yes, hi. Thank you, Carolyn, and it is always a pleasure, as everybody says, to speak on these calls. We reach so many people in so many different places who can access this information without leaving their home, and that's pretty extraordinary. I have a lot to cover in just a few minutes, so as a mostly New Yorker, I'll speak slowly, but I have to speak somewhat quickly. The treatment of pain from the whole person's point of view, from a biological, psychological, and spiritual perspective, is a complicated one in head and neck cancer. We would hope that patients can go all the way through treatment without having pain, but indeed we do know that pain is rather common in head and neck cancer, and we need to anticipate that, to advise everybody that it's going to happen, and also make sure that most people understand that persistent pain, pain that lasts way after the cancer treatment, is known but is rare, and that most people really are able to be pain-free to a great extent or fully after their treatment is over and after healing has taken place. In head and neck cancer, because cancer is so visible and because there are so many different functions that happen in the area depending upon the exact type of cancer, where it starts and where it has spread to, there are many functions that can be worsened by pain, and pain slows down some of the functions. So swallowing, chewing, speaking, can be problematic in head and neck cancer. And again, we want to be ahead of the curve and anticipate these problems as much as possible. Now, traditionally, pain medicines are used. Pain medicines come in a variety of different types. The opioid or what used to be called narcotic pain medicines, as well as medicines like Tylenol and aspirin and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medicines that are available over the counter. And each of those needs to be used in the best way possible at the proper time. Each of them has some side effects, and a qualified interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary head and neck cancer team knows how to use these medicines correctly right from the start. Many people try their best to avoid using pain medicines until the pain is really, really bad, and then it takes a lot more medicine to keep the pain under control, so it's best to work with your team to use them a little bit at a time in a way that makes sense and in a schedule that is dictated not by how much you really want to avoid taking the medicines, but by how long the medicines last in your system. Some of the medicines can make bleeding worse, so we try not to use the aspirin-like components for many patients during head and neck cancer treatment, but again, there are times at which we need to. The opioid medicine can be used safely. Many people are afraid that they will become dependent on it, and indeed dependence is common, but that's different than addiction, and your team will be able to explain the differences between them and help you through understanding how to use these medicines in the best way possible. Often patients are started on short-term medicine and then changed to long-term medicines, often through a patch, since swallowing may not be possible or may be painful as well. And certain medicines can be put through a feeding tube. Although many of the medicines have not been FDA approved for that use, we do it pretty commonly. There are helper medicines that can be used to minimize the amount of the opioid medicines that are prescribed. And again, that could be a whole teleconference in itself. But just be aware that taking more different types of medicine is not necessarily a bad thing. Sometimes if we mix categories here, we can actually help people stay on the least amount of opioid medicine necessary, and that's probably everybody's goal. Obviously, the pain can be worsened when you're upset, and being upset worsens pain. Having pain worsens being upset. So the psychosocial distress that comes with head and neck cancer and with pain, they all sort of grow on each other, and each of those areas needs to be addressed. It is difficult, and that is an understatement, going through this treatment. It throws off pretty much everything in your life for a few weeks or months. It affects your day-to-day operations, your ability to work, your ability to be productive, your ability to take care of your family. And often people who are caretakers find that they are dependent upon others to care for them, which is somewhat uncomfortable. These dimensions of pain and the care of head and neck cancer in general do need to be addressed. It is the rare person that just slides through treatment for head and neck cancer and is able to keep up with all of their activities of daily living. That's very unusual. However, the multidisciplinary team can certainly help with this. There is a national group called SPONC, which has chapters all throughout parts of the country and has many services available to patients who do not live near a SPONC support group, and lots of information for people so they are not alone. And both Cancer Care and SPONC can really, really help in a circumstance where people feel isolated because of their cancer. Of course, there's a spiritual aspect to pain for people who are quite spiritual. The multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary team often and should include a pastoral care or chaplain, somebody who is trained in the overlap between our spirituality and our treatment of a serious medical condition like cancer. There's a great relief in knowing that there's a spiritual component, and that for many people can say that God has let them down, and we find that there are a number of existential questions that arise during head and neck cancer like other cancers, but particularly when somebody is in pain and in great distress. So that is very much a part of the multidisciplinary or an interdisciplinary team that we have. One more word about the type of pain medicines you use, that some of the helper medicines, especially for pain that travels along a nerve tract, are someone addressed before called neuropathic pain rather than pain from the tissue injury itself. And those require different medicines. Sometimes these are medicines that were approved for one use but are actually used for a different use. And we need to make sure that there's a lot of education that goes into how to use these medicines in the best way possible. Also, some of the pain that arises during treatment for head and neck cancer can develop from infection, particularly candidal infection or thrush infection, and that is best treated with the proper anti-candidal medicines, antifungal medicines, and again, that's something that the multidisciplinary team should be able to address with you and actually check for whenever you come in on a regular basis for either your radiation or your chemotherapy. This sounds like a formidable time and a difficult time for people. It certainly is. It's a hard treatment to undergo, but most people come out the other end and after a period of healing can get back to all of their usual functions and are happy to put the treatment behind them after quite a bit of healing. The question about sadness and depression in cancer is something that is just a part of the process. We believe that about 25% of people going through cancer treatment get a serious depression, a depression that requires some sort of attention or treatment that may be a little more when we think about the comorbidities or the conditions that track along with head and neck cancer, because the use of alcohol and drugs, which can predispose people to cancer, can also predispose folks to serious depression. If you have had an episode of serious depression where you took to bed and couldn't function way before the cancer, please let your multidisciplinary team know. It is certainly a good idea to be involved in some sort of counseling right from the start. And again, depending upon the individual circumstances, sometimes antidepressant medicine is used sort of preventively. And it's also one of the medicines that's used to treat neuropathic pain. And sometimes two good outcomes can come from taking one medicine. So it's important to work with the team and advise them if there's been any alcohol or drug dependence or a history of serious depression in the past, and get attention for that before it becomes a problem. Just the everyday kind of sadness and anger about going through treatment is certainly on everybody's mind, and you'll see when you come in for your treatment that there are people who are dealing with the same thing. Some of them are a little ahead of you, some of them are just beginning their treatment, but no one can really sort of sit with this and is it should be expected to be happy. It's a difficult time, and the natural or expected response is to certainly be upset. Sometimes our well-meaning family members hope that we can cheerily go through our treatments, but that rarely, rarely happens. In the multidisciplinary toolbox, one of the things that is very important that the other speakers have alluded to now are a special attention to nutrition during head and neck cancer, whether you can swallow directly or you are having to use a feeding tube. A visit with an oncology nutritionist or registered dietitian who is familiar with the ins and outs of head and neck cancer treatment is essential at the beginning of your treatment, not after you lose weight. Losing weight, it makes it harder for everything to get better. It's harder to heal. It's harder to keep your energy up. Your fatigue can be worse. The amount of radiation and chemotherapy and even pain medicine needs to be adjusted if you continue to lose weight during your treatment. Many people are under the false impression that it's just hard to eat during chemotherapy or don't have an appetite during chemotherapy and radiation therapy because you're upset. But we do know that the body uses a whole lot more calories than anybody could ever expect, and a visit with the nutritionist or the dietitian can make sure that you remain as close to your ideal body weight as possible. And the team needs to be able to make sure that any supplements that you use are helping your treatment, not harming your treatment, not interfering with your treatment. Some of the over-the-counter supplements really need to be coordinated with the care that you're getting with the chemotherapy and the nausea medicines and the pain medicines and everything else that you're taking. There are a number of medicines that you can use to increase your appetite, but during treatment for head and neck cancer, people say, why would you increase my appetite when then I can't eat and I can't swallow? But we want to make sure that we do whatever we can to keep the ideal body weight as close to what is good for you as possible. And there are medicines that do that without increasing your appetite. Medicines like omega-3 fatty acids are a combination of amino acids, arginine, glycine, and beta-hydroxybutyrate can be helpful and are available in commercially made products. But again, this is something that shouldn't be self-prescribed, even though they are over-the-counter and should be done by your healthcare team. People mentioned the other tools in the toolbox, good dental care and preventive dental care. When we look at the myriad of ways that head and neck cancer affects all of us, one of the things we need to keep in mind is that because eating is can be such a dilemma during head and neck cancer, sometimes people will shy away from the social aspects of food that make our life rich. And it's a good idea to make sure that you're included and self-include in the kinds of family activities or activities with friends that almost always center around food in just about every society that we know of. Warn people about what's happening. Tell them you have too much saliva. Tell them you're dry. Tell them that you need to excuse yourself to use your feeding tube. But you want to include yourself in those activities and other activities because the treatment time between the surgery, the radiation therapy, and chemotherapy can go on for a number of weeks, and then healing can take a number of weeks after that. And we really want to make sure that your life is as meaningful during that period of time as possible within the limitations of what you have, so that when you're starting to feel better, you don't have as much ground to cover. So in our toolbox, we're adding even more tools, and the dentist and the nutritionist are two important things that the other callers had not been able to address. I think I've gone down the list that Dr. Messner has set up, and I'll stop here.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Fleischman. As always, for just a wonderfully compassionate and comprehensive presentation. Very excellent. Thank you very much. And so much to teach everybody on the call and so much to say. So I want to thank you very much. Our next speaker is Dr. Sharon Bober. Dr. Bober is Director of Sexual Health Program, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Perini Family Survivor Center. And Dr. Bober is going to address intimacy and sexual adjustments and body image reintegration and quality of life. These are very important topics, and I'm delighted to have Dr. Bober with us today, who's an expert in this area. Dr. Bober?
Thanks, Carolyn. I very much want to thank Cancer Care for the opportunity to be with you all today. And just to say that thinking about sexuality and sort of sex after head and neck cancer, it's just important to note that this is really one of the most common quality of life issues that head and neck cancer patients face. It's certainly something that the majority of our patients say that they are worried about, and the truth is it's often the elephant in the room for so many of our patients and providers, where it's on people's mind and often doesn't get brought up. Just to clarify, when I talk about sex and sexuality, to say that this is really, I think, a fundamental aspect of human experience that really goes across the lifespan. It's certainly not just about intercourse or sort of the act of sex, but it is also about emotion, how we think and how we feel, and also about relationships. And also, it is different in meaning and levels of importance to each individual. So we know that there is a very wide and varied range of normal function, but certainly if there are changes that are distressing, they need to be addressed. So more specifically, I also want to say that I think sexuality is probably one of the most life-affirming elements of our experience. I think in terms of quality of life, it can actually ease anxiety and release stress. It certainly can maintain a sense of physical and emotional connection, and it has really, I think, positive benefits both for patients and partners, and that the work we do is certainly in the context of supporting healing and recovery. So Just to also note that, again, I think communication about sexuality is often very limited. I think both providers and patients are often anxious or uncomfortable about where to start, and I really want to say both at the beginning and at the end of this that it's an important topic, and everyone deserves to have attention to this topic if they're concerned about it, and people really should not be worried about bringing up the topic because there are resources, and we have lots of targeted strategies to help people with this aspect of their life. So certainly in terms of head and neck cancer in particular, it's very common that people experience changes in, as we've talked about, body image, disfigurement, and function, and that sex is typically one of the first aspects of normal life that gets disrupted. Unfortunately, a majority of our patients tell us that they were not fully prepared for dealing with these changes. So thinking about how we address some of these changes, the model we really take in terms of sexuality is to really think about the relationship between both mind, body, and relationship. And as everyone has sort of mentioned on the call today, the way we treat head and neck cancer is really often a combination approach, but typically surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy are the tools in that toolkit. And unfortunately, all of those treatments have the potential to impact the various domains of sexuality. So, you know, the way we think and feel, how our body's working, and the relationship itself can all be impacted by the various range of cancer treatment. So what does this mean in terms of what we need to do? Well, in each of these domains, we need to figure out where things are working and where things are not working. So if people have changes in self-image and body image and people don't perceive themselves to be attractive or someone might not feel feminine or masculine the way they used to, we really need to think about how people can feel comfortable in their body again and what we can do to help people kind of retune into their body. Often going through an aggressive treatment, we sort of tune out a little bit in order to get through treatment, and then we really need to think about what it means to sort of connect to ourselves, including our body, and where we can feel pleasure for often the sort of first time after quite a while when treatment ends. Similarly, we need to be aware of how we think and how we feel and the connection between thinking and feeling. So this is to say that when we are worried, for example, that our partner might or might not be attracted to us anymore, that also makes us feel badly and then makes one quite convinced, for example, that, you know, I'm not going to be able to date again or somebody's not going to want to approach. And this might well be this, you know, as much as something somebody's worried about without any real validation. And again, couples often don't talk about it. So we really need to sort of figure out where thinking and feeling is and how we might be able to address some of the ways that they're changed. Or, for example, people might have errors in thinking that, you know, my partner doesn't want to approach me because they're not attracted to me. It might be the case that your partner's not approaching because they're worried. They don't want to pressure you, and people have misperceptions of each other. So moving along in terms of rehab about body changes, I think it's important to say that even though patients often find that things are not the same after cancer and cancer treatment, it's very important that people realize that they can still have pleasure, that people might find that they need to sort of remap the body and figure out what parts of their experience is still very much able to take in sensuality, sensation, and that it's really an opportunity to, in a sense, get out of the old mindset and to think differently about what you've done before. You can expand the repertoire. You can include your partner as part of that conversation about what might be different, but what might also feel good, be pleasurable again. I think our focus needs to be on pleasure and sensation, not just about trying to do what we used to do, because sometimes that's possible and sometimes that might take quite a while. But the point is that sexuality does not have to be something that people give up on. It does not have to be something that people feel that they no longer have because they had to sort of give that up in order to stay alive. That's really not the case. I also just want to say quickly that low desire is a very, very common a problem for so many of our patients, and that there is a lot of help out there in terms of being able to help people kind of rekindle that aspect of their life, to restart that experience of desire. Desire is complicated in that it's a really a recipe with many ingredients, but that it is not something that once it wanes, you can't get back. So we certainly can figure out how to help acknowledge change and accept loss, but again, we really have an opportunity to chart a new course and really help folks kind of rekindle desire by going through a variety of treatments that are both behavioral, that are about emotion and cognition, and we work very closely with partners and really think about how to help partners communicate, restart, and really sort of think about sexual rehabilitation and sort of any other part of rehab in terms of something that they can get back to after cancer. So I'm aware that time is moving along, and I don't have much time left, but just to say that there are also many resources available, and that, like as we do at the Dana-Farber, we take a multidisciplinary approach to this problem. I think that patients can really feel that they can advocate for the topic to come up. Please don't wait for your provider to bring up the topic, because often they won't, and that's okay. You know, find someone on your treatment team that you feel comfortable with, whether that is a nurse, a social worker, maybe it's your oncologist, and to say, listen, this is a part of my life that I'm afraid is different or changing, and I need some support here. And if he or she isn't clear about what to do immediately, they can certainly help think about what the resources are in the community. Also think that through the American Cancer Society, the Lance Armstrong Foundation, for example, there are a number of terrific resources online that patients can access about resuming sexual function after cancer. And also, again, working with a team of people so that they are able to sort of address the multiple aspects of sexual function is very important, and know that there are a number of strategies out there that are very effective at helping people really regain and renew sexuality after cancer.
Thank you so much, Dr. Barber. Just a wonderful presentation and very important for everyone to hear on the call today. And I hope that everyone on the call today will hear what you've said and will actually go back to your multidisciplinary team and work with them on any concerns and issues you may have, as well as all the resources and all the organizations that are available to help you. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Glenn Mucci, and Glenn is an oncology social worker, and he's coordinator at Cancer Care. And Glenn is going to address the services that you can access from Cancer Care, the free services. Glenn?
Thank you, Carolyn, and I'd like to thank everyone for participating in today's Connect Education Workshop. In closing, I would like to speak briefly about the services that Cancer Care provides. The array of challenges presented by oral and head and neck cancer may feel overwhelming at times and impact our ability to cope. We may find ourselves faced with many questions and decisions that have to be made insofar as our care is concerned. Seeking help, although help is a good thing, may even sometimes be an additional burden to us. Help is available, however. Cancer Care offers free individual counseling by professional oncology social workers who can walk with you and provide a listening ear. A Cancer Care social worker can help you sort through the myriad of issues that may surround pain management, for instance, and your quality of life during this period. We heard so much today about how integral and important teamwork is to a person's quality care and recovery. Social workers can offer tips and suggestions to help open doors to effective communication with your healthcare team, which in turn can help improve self-image and self-esteem. They can direct you to additional resources and offer guidance as you navigate through the sometimes complex system of managed care. The cancer experience can frequently leave us feeling alone. I really cannot underestimate the significance, therefore, of individual counseling and support groups. Individual counseling can afford us a safe space to talk about our feelings and provide us an opportunity to process what we may be experiencing. Through individual counseling, we can learn new coping strategies and develop ways to ensure our continued coping and adjustment to the biopsychosocial and spiritual component of the cancer experience. The social interaction offered by support groups can also diminish feelings of isolation and help us cope. Support groups provide a safe and supportive environment where we not only can share our cancer story with others, but learn from those who may be experiencing similar feelings, fears, and concerns as well. They afford us a place where we can talk about our diagnosis and treatment and discuss the issues that may surround survivorship and our ability to cope with the side effects that we may be experiencing. At Cancer Care, people can gain emotional support, insight, and assurance by participating in free telephone and online support groups. These groups are open to people with cancer, their family and friends, caregivers, survivors, and the bereaved.
I want to thank you very much, Glenn, for just telling everyone about all the services of Cancer Care. And I want everyone on the call to feel that you're not alone, that you're part of a community of support. We're here for you. Please do call us. And I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all for participating.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.